From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
From picky eaters to poor sleepers, raising a child can be an adventure.
That's one way to put it. A new Mayo Clinic book aims to help parents navigate these challenges.
On today's program, we'll talk with the medical editor of the Mayo Clinic Guide to Raising a Healthy Child.
But if we can kind of work prophylactically, you know, starting pretty young to teach them ups and downs and to stand back as parents and let them struggle a little bit, that's okay. And that's where children are going to develop those resiliency skills that allow them to adapt and persevere in the face of the ups and downs that are sure to come in the future.
Later on the program, Ian Roth joins me as co-host. We'll learn about a common cause of back pain.
And research on women who snore and cardiac disease.
That's this week's program.
Well, the Mayo Clinic is out with another book. This one is called The Mayo Clinic Guide to Raising a Healthy Child. It helps parents navigate the many twists and turns of parenting by offering a trusted guide to raising children during the preschool and the elementary school years.
The good old days.
Yes. The book draws from the collective wisdom of multiple Mayo Clinic pediatric experts, and it addresses key questions and concerns that many parents have. And, you know, I don't know one parent who doesn't have a concern or a question about raising their child.
Joining us is the medical editor of Guide to Raising a Healthy Child, Dr. Angela Matke. She is a pediatrician at Mayo Clinic's Children's Center. She has a special interest in using social media to connect with patients and families and hosts a Facebook live show called hashtag Ask the Mayo Mom.
Yes,
very popular.
Hey, Mom.
She lives in Rochester with her husband and two sons. Dr. Matke, it's great to have you here again.
Thanks for having me back.
Dr. Matke, I would assume that compiling a book like this and editing it is a pretty big undertaking. Why'd you decide to do it?
Right. Yeah, it was a really large undertaking. It required a lot of people's input and expert. But the reason why we decided to do it is there's a lot of information out there, and it's really hard for parents to know what's accurate and what information you can trust. And as you mentioned, this book is a collaboration with over 20 experts in pediatric health from Mayo Clinic. And we really do see Mayo Clinic as a trusted source of information. And we wanted to make sure that information's out there with the latest evidence-based recommendations about how to raise your child in the 21st century, but also wanted to present it in a way that's pragmatic, practical, and adaptable to your life. Because, you know, very, very strict guidelines are really hard to live by, at least for my family. And so we're trying to make it so families, they find it useful.
How did you decide what to put in the book?
Right. I am a general pediatrician, and I made sure that we included the questions that I'm hearing from my patients and my families every day in the office. Plus, I'm a mom myself, and I put information there that I also want to know, and we talked to a lot of different people. We wanted to make sure that things that maybe haven't been included in previous parenting books, because parenting's changing, just like it has for all different generations in the past, there's new challenges, and we wanted to make sure that those were also being addressed as well.
And how did you decide what to put in the book? Did you want to cover virtually everything, every issue, every concern?
Yeah, we covered absolutely everything. No, I'm sure we missed a couple things, but we tried to really hit the topics that we thought were important and the topics that there's evidence out there on. And so when there's a really clear consensus about this being healthy for your child, we wanted to make sure it was included. Or in contrastingly, if there's concerns about safety or ways that we can kind of help encourage resilience in our children and help address some of the mental health concerns that we're seeing becoming increasing, especially in our teenage population, we wanted to make sure that information is there, because that's what parents are asking for and that's what they want to know about.
I was going to ask, that must be one of the things that is added to something that's now a new compilation of mm-hmm. what to work with your kid.
Right.
It has to be mental health and screens, because those are the two things that we do a lot of interviews about.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was a really big aspect of what I wanted to make sure was highlighted in the book. We have a whole chapter that addresses behaviors and emotions, but really from a preventive kind of approach, because when kids are struggling, like many children do, it's a little bit harder to get the treatments and get things to be back to being their kind of usual equilibrium. But if we can kind of work prophylactically, you know, starting pretty young to teach them ups and downs and to stand back as parents and let them struggle a little bit, that's okay. And that's where children are going to develop those resiliency skills that allow them to adapt and persevere in the face of the ups and downs that are sure to come in the future.
Seems like we're hearing more and more about bullying. How do you advise parents approach that with their kids?
I think one of the first things would be just prophylactically talking about it, asking their children about it. But, you know, we talk about a lot of the kids that are being bullied, but there are, you know, a good amount of kids that are actually doing the bullying too. So making sure that you're talking to your kids and making sure they're not doing those things. And then once, if your kid does come to you with concerns about being bullied, it's really important to, first of all, like, just take a big breath and step back, because I think your first impulse is to go in and just want to fix things, right? Talk to the school, talk to that parent of that child, but that's not going to help the situation, and that might not be what your child wants too. So the first thing is just gather more information. Talk to your child about what's going on. Make sure you're not blaming your child if your child is the victim, because that does happen, that kind of victim shaming sometimes. And then going forward about asking your child what they want to do about it. What kind of path forward does that look like for them? Because it's going to be different in every situation. And then find out where it's happening at. You want, as a parent, to sometimes just pull them out of that situation. But that actually can be detrimental, because it might be a really important social output they could be getting a lot of support from, and you might be removing that support by taking them out of that situation. So instead, figure out ways that your child can be safe in that environment, partnering with the schools, partnering with whatever extracurricular activity that it might be occurring in.
Back to the mental health part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever be able to have a world where there is no bullying, but trying to figure out ways to help all kids involved on what to deal with it is what it's all about.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the health outcomes are detrimental to kids that are bullied, as well as the kids that actually do bully. And so their, you know, substance abuse and future likelihood to commit violence for those that do bully are concerns, as well as the kids that are being bullied. And so it has to be, you know, a proactive, holistic approach. And we also need to teach kids and let them work through conflict. You know, those minimal conflicts, we don't need to go in and try and solve those for them, because that helps teach them some skills to navigate things going forward, because there's conflict in everyday life as an adult, right? And so that starts early, and it's not fun as a parent to sit back and just kind of help your child through these situations, but it's an also really important thing, like I talked about with that resilience. You know, it's those little baby steps. You can find these opportunities and situations before you kind of get to really significant things like bullying, where you do need to be part of that solution.
When is it okay to get a child a cell phone?
That's a great question. There is no right age. So it depends on what works for you and your family. It depends on the child. Some children may be ready at 11. Some children may not developmentally or emotionally be ready to take on that responsibility until they're older. And so there's, you know, things that families should look for. You know, can they follow directions? Can they follow rules? Do they understand consequences and behavior, and kind of setting down before you get to that point and talking about what it would look like and what your expectations would be is a really good proactive approach. And then, you know what, your kid's going to mess up with their cell phone. That's part of being a kid, right? And that's part of being a human, is just making mistakes. So you need to be kind of part of observing that social media use, that cell phone use, that screen time use as they're getting it, so you can kind of teach them and craft their use of it going forward.
But 11 would be about the earliest?
I would say so. I mean, I think that there's, in most situations, they typically don't need it. There's always somebody who has a phone if they needed to get in contact with you. It's not like we're in a world nowadays where people are not in touch. People are always worried that they have to be able to get in contact with their kid at that exact time. But there's usually other ways you can get around it. Because otherwise, you're starting to introduce that screen pretty early. Kids are starting to become pretty dependent on it. And it's not unusual for kids to use 5 to 10 hours of screen time per day or more. So
as long as you're on screen time, talk a little bit more about that. Computer time, video game time. Are there some limits there that you have to set? Tracy, I think this is of extreme interest to you, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I've got a 14-year-old, so I don't think that this book is for...
It isn't. No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I will say is that my 14-year-old son used to more readily admit when he had too much screen time, and because he could feel the addiction part of
it, and
didn't like the way that made him feel.
Yeah.
Now that he's getting older, he doesn't tip his cards on that one so much.
Yeah, and it's true.
He's managing the addiction differently.
It is, and you know, they're being raised in a digital world. This is a part of their life, and us trying to completely take it out of it is not the right way forward, right? Their school, their social interactions, everything is immersed with it. So we just need to find some type of balance and moderation, you know, as you navigate the different years and the teen years that can be challenging. There's no right way. There's no right answer for anyone, because every family is going to be different.
Moderation in all we do. Yeah. We are with the medical editor of the new Mayo Clinic book called Guide to Raising a Healthy Child. Dr. Angela Matke is our guest. She's a pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic. Is there anything in this book that you've used raising your own children? You have a couple of boys?
I've probably used all of this in this book, although I'm not, you know, I'm not the perfect parent, so I'm making lots of mistakes, but that's a really important message that we have in the book.
Let's talk about summertime. Summer brings all of its own challenges.
Absolutely. I think the first message we want to get across to families is, like, we want you to be outside. It's not all about safety. Sometimes as a pediatrician, that's all we're talking about. But we want you to be out there as a family, being active, moving, trying new things and stuff. But just remember some safety things as you kind of go through this process of summer. The most common thing that we talk about is sun safety, right? The effects of the UVA, UVB rays are there whether the sun is out or whether it's cloudy. And so it's important to wear protective clothing and making sure that you're applying some type of UVA, UVB protective sunscreen. And you need to apply it frequently and you need to apply it generously. I think that's one the biggest mistakes that people play have is that they don't apply it thick enough. Every time you get out of the water, you need to also reapply it. Also, you know, the sun can be hard to be around, right? It gets hot and humid in most places across the United States. And so people need to be aware that kids are a little bit more likely to experience the effects of the sun and heat exhaustion before you may experience them. And same with the elderly, too. So think about your grandparents and stuff as well. And so make sure that, you know, you're drinking lots of water, you're avoiding the sun at the highest hours, which is going to be between 10 and 4. Also, make sure you're wearing light and breathable clothing. And then look for signs of heat exhaustion. In children, it can be nausea, vomiting, fever, headaches, abdominal pain, muscle pain and weakness, and just changes in how they're acting. And that's a late and very concerning sign. Usually headache and just not urinating as frequently is another sign. So if you're already starting to feel some of that, your child definitely is. So you guys need to get inside. You need to rehydrate. Cool baths can be really helpful. Making sure that they're, you know, in water and things like that can also be helpful. But they need to be urinating pretty frequently. If your child's urine, sorry to talk about that, is yellow, they're probably pretty dehydrated. So you need to be focusing more on water. And water is typically just fine. Most kids don't need to have some of the sugary beverages and stuff for electrolyte replacement unless they're doing really heavy exercise.
So yellow means it's too concentrated.
Absolutely.
They ought to be getting more fluid.
Yes, thank you.
The other thing I don't think a lot of people understand is that the effects of the sun are cumulative. Mm-hmm. So the sun exposure that you had when you're a kid, the effects don't go away. They just accumulate more and more over time, and your skin gets damaged from a young age.
Absolutely.
And that damage as a youngster doesn't go away.
Right. You know, sunburns in the first 18 years of life and have a tenfold increased risk of developing skin cancer later in life. And so it's those sunburns when you're laying out as a teenager trying to get, you know, that tan that really are super important. You don't think about it, you know, what it's going to be like in your 50s and 60s.
So. Yeah, well, we all did that with a little baby oil.
Yep. Yeah.
Trying to get as tan as we could.
But we also looked at it as you get your first sunburn of the season. For us, that was part of summertime.
Yeah,
just get a bad burn,
agree. I remember that as a child as well, so. Mm-hmm.
What about trampolines?
Great question.
No, you can have one.
As an orthopedic surgeon, definitely. I think orthopedic surgeons, trauma surgeons, emergency room physicians, it's probably one of their least favorite things because we do see a lot of injuries in children in these. We don't want to discourage use, but we want to make sure it's smart use, right? So the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that kids generally under age 6 are not jumping on them. The other thing is if you have multiple different ages of kids jumping on them, that's when there's a lot of higher risk because you got someone with a lot of body mass and you have someone with less and less ability to control themselves. And that's where we see some of the bigger injuries happening. The other thing,
so 6 is the limit.
Six is the recommended age. Also, you know, a lot of trampolines, you got to have that ladder to get up it. And so make sure you're putting that ladder up when it's not in use. Another thing that offers a false sense of security is the kind of netting around it. Mm-hmm. It's not going to prevent injuries. Like people think it's like it's one and done and you're covered, and that's not necessarily true.
You mentioned sugary drinks, mm-hmm. and so that just kind of segues into childhood obesity.
Right. We're definitely seeing childhood obesity, increase over the past 20 years or more. Thankfully, it's starting to slow down a little bit with the increases. But if you're talking about obese and overweight, which incorporates a BMI, which is your body mass index based on your sex, that's 85 and above. And we are starting to see a lot of it, but it's not just how much you're eating and it's not just sugary drinks. We have a greater availability to higher calorie foods, portion sizes have increased. We're having more sedentary lifestyles, but there's also things that we're starting to understand more and more with researches about genetics and how that modifies your risk factors for becoming obese and continuing to be something that persists throughout adulthood.
Is it okay to put your child on a diet?
No, that is not something I would ever recommend unless it's been recommended by, you know, an endocrinologist that's, you know, in a weight management program for pediatric patients. First and foremost, diets don't work, right? We know that diets don't work. We see this yo-yoing effect, and usually they result in higher weight gain in adults after people have gone on a diet. And also, it's more of a prevention perspective that we really tried to advocate in our book, in that prevention of both obesity and prevention of eating disorders, because the approach is pretty similar. And it's a preventative, balanced, healthy, pragmatic approach for kids. Instead of telling them what they can't eat, give them healthy options of what they can eat. Make it a positive perspective. Make it family going forward, so everyone's included with it. And then making sure you're teaching your kids about other lifestyle things, because, you know, they need to be active. They need to practice other things in moderation as well.
If you serve them healthy food and they turn their nose up at it, sooner or later they'll eat it, right? If they get hungry enough?
Well, you know, the research shows kids need about 8 to 10 exposures of a food before they can really kind of develop taste buds about whether they like it or not. I mean, I can think about this in my childhood, right? Things I would never eat then, I love now, right? I've multiple different exposures really kind of opened those taste buds and the ways that I like food. So one, you're not responsible for making your child like a food. What you can do is, you know, offer it, encourage it, present it in a way that's interesting, get them involved with food prep, which can be really interesting, get them involved with purchasing food in the grocery store so they learn to make these kind of balanced choices can be really helpful.
I'm going to cross my fingers and hope that you included something about sleep in this book.
We have a whole chapter about sleep. Don't worry.
Good. Because I think when we're talking about poor food, you know, junk food, I often will tell my kids, we do junk food, you do junk sleep. Not every day, but just on occasion. Mm-hmm. And that's something that makes a big difference for them.
Yeah, when they've kind of experienced the sleep and it's gotten off the routine.
Junk sleep.
Yeah. It's, you know, routines are important for kids, but, you know, there's going to be times that the routine can't be followed because of other circumstances. But kids in general need really regimented sleep. They need routines. They need to be going to bed about the same time. They need to be waking up at about the same time. We also covered a lot of really common sleep problems that we see in this age group from 3 to 11, and hopefully some pragmatic tips to kind of help people with, especially those more behavioral sleep problems that are the more common ones that we see, you know, kids pushing bedtimes, not wanting to go to bed on their own, all those things that I know that I've experienced as a parent myself. So
it's a Mayo mom. You know, it's not easy raising children these days. And actually, I don't think it ever was. Mm-hmm. You know, from picky eaters to poor sleepers, Mayo Clinic's new book, Guide to Raising a Healthy Child, offers tips for raising a happy, healthy, well-adjusted child. Now, what parent wouldn't want to know how to do that?
Sounds like a great baby gift.
It's available wherever fine books are sold, and I saw it's on Amazon for $15.75. So what a bargain.
I guess he's already bought one.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Mackey.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, Ian Roth joins me as co-host. We'll learn more about a common cause of back pain.
And research on women who snore and cardiac disease. And now, here's the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams for the Mayo Clinic News Network. Here's some more on the opioid issue. A Mayo Clinic study finds that surgical patients receiving the opioid tramadol have a somewhat higher risk of prolonged use than those receiving other common opioids. However, the Drug Enforcement Administration classifies tramadol as a Schedule 4 controlled substance, meaning it's considered to have a lower risk of addiction and abuse than Schedule 2 opioids, such as oxycodone and hydrocodone. The study was published in the journal BMJ. The lead author of the study, Dr. Cornelius Thiel, says this data will force them to reevaluate their post-surgical prescribing guidelines. And while tramadol may still be an acceptable option for some patients, their data suggests they should be as cautious with tramadol as they are with other short-acting opioids. And moving on, let's talk about what's called wedding ring rash. Wedding rings are a symbol of love and unity. They can also be a source of an itchy red rash. So does this mean you have to remove your ring? Dr. Don Davis, a Mayo Clinic dermatologist, says wedding ring rashes are common and may be a sign of an allergy. But in many cases, the rash is the result of another easily treatable issue. Dr. Davis says wedding ring dermatitis sounds like a term that somebody would develop on their fourth finger from a prominent piece of jewelry, such as a wedding ring, because they're allergic to the metal. Now, this may happen, but Dr. Davis adds that most cases are caused by something else. She says the issue was nicknamed wedding ring dermatitis because it was found most often when people were wearing wedding rings. It's often not an allergic sensitivity to the components of your jewelry, but rather it's an irritant contact dermatitis from simply the accumulation of soap residue or sweat and dirt under your ring. And it happens frequently to people who actually wash their hands a lot. Dr. Davis says some people will be in a hurry to wash and won't get enough water when they rinse under their ring, and so dirt and sweat and soap residue can get stuck under your ring on your finger. And then what happens is, over time, it becomes an irritant to the skin, and you develop an eczema reaction. The solution? Be sure to wash, rinse, and dry thoroughly under your rings. If that doesn't help, talk to your healthcare provider. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Ian Roth.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Spondylolisthesis is a forward slip of one vertebrae over another. The term comes from the Greek language. Spondylo means vertebra, and listhesis means to slip. Spondylolisthesis occurs most often in the lumbar spine, or the lower part of the back.
There are many causes for spondylolisthesis. A vertebrae might be defective from the time a person is born, or it could be broken by trauma or a stress fracture. Commonly, the disorder occurs in children and adolescents who are active in athletics, such as gymnastics. Here to discuss is Mayo Clinic orthopedic surgeon Dr. Brett Friedman. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Friedman. How common is spondylolisthesis?
Well, first, thanks for having me back.
Yes.
It's always fun to be here. So you mentioned there's two primary basic types. One is a sort of a defective type of spine, one in which there's a small crack that develops early on in life in the back of the spine, typically at the lowest lumbar level, which is L5. And when that part, which is called the pars, breaks, that releases the spine and allows it to slip forward. And so that particular version of spondylolisthesis is present in about 5 to 6% of Americans. There's some genetic predisposition, and so there's certain groups of people, specifically certain types of Eskimos, in which that rate jumps up to 22%. And then the other type is degenerative spondylolisthesis, and that occurs because of the way in which the spine ages. The spine has 24 vertebrae, and between each vertebra is a disc, which is that shock absorber. Mm-hmm. As that shock absorber ages, it tends to lose its height. And all the ligaments that support the spine are tensioned at the right height. And so as you lose the height, there's some people that become a little bit sloppy with their motion and it can develop the slip. So we see those in older people. And over the age of 60, the rate of spondylolisthesis can be as high as 30%. And so for many people, spondylolisthesis, whether it's the lytic type, which is the type that happens young, or the degenerative type, which happens older in life, these are incidental findings caught because my stomach hurts and I get an x-ray of my abdomen. The vast majority of us will live with our spondylolisthesis and either have no idea it's there or have no reason to see a spine surgeon. But when the cat's out of the bag and this becomes a symptomatic and a episodically symptomatic problem, that's when we start to think about doing what we do.
But a lot of people complain about back pain all the time, especially lower back pain. Is this something that people should go and get checked out? Do I have spondylolisthesis?
Back pain is really something that all humans get at some point in their life. And so we really need to wrap our heads around that. It's sort of one of the costs of being a human being and walking upright is that we will have back pain. Some of us will have more than others, and some of us have some body traits that increase that, some genetic traits that increase that. But when you have such a common problem as back pain, something that's second only to the common cold in terms of primary care visits, you wind up with a lot of people have a similar problem, and so we can come up with a sort of defined way in which we work up back pain. And that workup includes x-rays after 4 to 6 weeks of sustained symptoms. And so most spondylolisthesis would be detected at that point in time. Certainly any significant spondylolisthesis would be detected. So it's not something that you need to look for independently. It's something that's sort of part and built into the process. But it is one of the treatable causes of back pain.
Back pain is kind of a catch-all. What kind of back pain are we talking about?
Typically, it's a mechanical back pain. But again, back pain is nonspecific.
Right.
And even mechanical pain can be nonspecific. So what's mechanical pain? That's pain that's worse with activity, better with rest. And one of the treatments for back pain related to degenerative changes of the spine or problems in the spine is that we fuse the spine. And so essentially, we put it at permanent rest. And so if you're someone that has pain continuously, that's a very different person than someone that has a pure mechanical pain, which is I feel wonderful at rest and I feel awful with motion and activity. And towards the end of the day, it gets worse. And so that piece of information, that the quality of the pain is important. But mechanical quality back pain is something that is quite common in spondylolisthesis and probably one of the reasons why addressing it when all else has failed, and it's certainly the last step to do surgery, is a meaningful intervention for about 3/4 of people.
Yeah, I was going to say fusion surgery does not sound like someplace you want to go, so I'm glad it's the last resort. But what do you do before surgery then? What are other options for treatment?
And so, and I think that's an important piece of the puzzle, is understanding that the spondylolisthesis doesn't separate you from the rest of humanity. So we treat it like we treat back pain. And so we talk about a spine healthy lifestyle, which includes optimizing your body weight, optimizing body mechanics, including cardiovascular exercise, weight bearing exercise, ensuring that you're not too sedentary. And so doing things that take care of yourself, that's where it all starts. And then when that's not successful and activity modification isn't successful, then we go up our ladder of treatment. Next up on the rung would be your physical therapies. Next up would be medications, or you can reverse the order of those rungs. And then the fourth step on the ladder would be an injection. And so there are specific types of injections, specifically PARS injections, which are injections to that little crack in the 5-6% that have the lytic type of spondylolisthesis, that can be very telling. Oftentimes they're not therapeutic, which is to say they're not curative of the problem, but they at least tell us this is what pain is stemming from this location, and they can give us some confidence in moving forward towards the fifth step on the ladder, which is surgery.
You kind of touched on it a little bit there, but are there other things that people can do to avoid these kinds of problems?
Certainly. Back pain is a product of genetics plus exposures. And in some people, it's purely the exposure, so it's the life you've chosen or a trauma that's occurred to you. In other people, it's purely the genetics. And no matter how pristine your life, you're still going to have a problem. And so some mixture is inbred in each and every one of us. And so all we can modify is the exposures piece. So we can modify what we look like, what we do, and how we behave. And we can also modify how we feel about ourselves, because there's certainly a strong psychosocial aspect of all back pain as well.
That phrase that you used, spine healthy lifestyle, is something that I don't know if a guest has ever used that phrase, but it makes a ton of sense when it comes to a lot of the different back issues that we talk about on this program. What exactly does a spine healthy lifestyle mean to you?
Sure. That's great. So it is my catch-all phrase, and I think every single patient that sees me is at risk of getting my little handout on that subject. And so that includes the ideas of obtaining an ideal body weight, of engaging in cardiovascular exercise on a regular basis, 3-4 times per week. It includes the ideas of moderation of alcohol intake, not smoking, both of which decrease your chances of negative outcomes with your spine, specifically bone softening and also pain and disc degeneration in terms of smoking. It includes setting up an ergonomic work environment, so things are in good reach and that you sit with your feet on the ground, and also maintaining good flexibility. We all should be able to touch somewhere close to our ankles when we're standing up as we bend forward. And then it includes overall just trying to make sure that we have a healthy outlook on life too, because pain begets pain, and there is a strong piece of this back problem that's called biopsychosocial. It's unlike many things. When I break a bone, that's pretty much a physiological and anatomic phenomena. But when I have back pain, that is a holistic thing. And so we need to make sure we touch on all three aspects.
We've been talking about treatment for spondylolisthesis. I'll work on it some more.
I hear you. I try it on my YouTube.
With Mayo Clinic orthopedic surgeon Dr. Brett Friedman and the importance of a spine-healthy lifestyle. Thank you so much, Dr. Friedman.
Thank you.
Snoring is often associated with a sleep disorder called obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA. People with OSA often snore loudly and have breathing patterns where they stop breathing and start again over and over while they sleep. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, at least 18 million adults in the U.S. have sleep apnea.
While it's unclear whether or not sleep apnea directly causes heart disease, we do know that people with sleep apnea are at risk of developing hypertension or high blood pressure. And according to a new study, snoring and OSA may lead to heart problems earlier for women than for men. Here to discuss snoring and the effect on cardiovascular health is Mayo Clinic cardiologist Dr. Varen Summers. Welcome to the program, Dr. Summers. It's nice to meet you.
Thanks, Tracy, and thanks, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Anybody who sleeps in the same room or the same bed with someone knows if they have sleep apnea, but why is it important to diagnose it?
So sleep apnea has several issues. The first is just the fact that the bed partner is disturbed. So what we find is that the bed partner of people with significant sleep apnea actually are themselves clinically sleep deprived. So right at the outset, we have the issue of the bed partner having health risks from sleep deprivation because of the snoring of the other partner. For the person who snores, and not everybody who snores is at risk, so we have to remember that snoring is a continuum. So it's like blood pressure. It goes from mild, from non-existent to mild to severe to plain apneic snoring. And you know, very often people who snore also have obstructive sleep apnea. And the ones who snore very disruptively, who actually stop breathing during sleep, the bed partner sees it, what we call a witnessed apnea, those people almost certainly have significant sleep apnea. For the people who snore without diagnosed sleep apnea, you can imagine that a substantial percentage of them actually have sleep apnea as well. So we have to think that maybe the harm from snoring actually comes from the fact that they have undiagnosed sleep apnea.
So why, we know that sleep apnea can be hard on the heart. Why is that? Why is it causing problems on the heart?
For many reasons. So the first reason is that when you have apnea, you stop breathing. So your oxygen level falls and your carbon dioxide level goes up. Those two changes, a low oxygen and a high carbon dioxide, actually trigger receptors in the peripheral blood vessels and in the brain that increase your sympathetic nerve traffic. So sympathetic outflow is your fight or flight response. And it is an adrenaline-like response that causes your blood vessels to vasoconstrict, in other words, to tighten up. So that raises your blood pressure. So with every apnea, you have a very marked increase in blood pressure, sometimes to levels as high as 200 during sleep. Okay, so that in itself, those repetitive increases in blood pressure tend to put some stress on the heart and raise the blood pressure and thereby increase the thickening of the heart. The second problem with sleep apnea in the heart is because these people are struggling to breathe, you got to get back to why are they not breathing well. They are obstructed because during inspiration, the upper airway collapses like a wet paper straw. Why does it collapse? Because when they're asleep, particularly when they're dreaming, they lose muscle tone. So they lose muscle tone in the body, and that's designed to stop them from acting out their dreams. Oh. The problem is we also have muscle in the upper airway, and that muscle also loses its tone, which means that when they breathe in, the airway collapses. Okay, so that's obstructed. So what does a patient do? He or she breathes in really deeply, struggles, and creates a huge negative pressure in the chest to try and overcome that blockage. Now, that negative pressure is being created around the heart, and parts of the heart are very thin-walled, like what we call the atrium, the upper chamber. So if it's like putting the atrium or the heart into a vacuum. Okay, so it stretches the heart, causes the heart to stretch outwards, particularly the atrium, because that causes what we think of as left atrial enlargement. So there are several other mechanisms by which the heart can be damaged, but those, I would say, are the two principal ones. The fact that blood pressure gets up to very high levels during sleep, and the second being that the heart is constantly subjected to these repetitive episodes of negative intrathoracic pressure in the chest, negative pressure in the chest during sleep.
If people have high blood pressure when they're sleeping, damaging the heart while that's happening, while they're sleeping, but during the day, do they still have high blood pressure? Or when they go in to get their blood pressure checked, is it regular?
Right. So great question. So what we're finding is that if you have this high sympathetic drive during sleep, this adrenaline drive, that seems to carry over into daytime wakefulness. So if you look at sympathetic activation in an untreated apneic patient, they will often have very high levels of sympathetic activity. Now, what about blood pressure? That is true for blood pressure as well. These high levels of blood pressure seem to predict the development of high daytime blood pressure in the future.
Why may women be at greater risk than men when it comes to sleep apnea and heart disease that is caused by it? Right.
So to put this in perspective, at this point, we have some indications that women may be at greater risk, although the evidence is not compelling and definitive. Mm-hmm. And why is that? It's because women, one in four middle-aged men probably has significant sleep apnea. One in 10 middle-aged women probably has significant sleep apnea. This means that sleep apnea seems to affect men far more than women. Because of that, apnea in women hasn't received as much attention. Oh. Most of the patients are men, so everything's being done in men. The studies are being done in men. Women are kind of been, I wouldn't say neglected, but yes, neglected, mainly because it's less prevalent in them. But what we're finding is that, yes, it may be less common, but it's not in any way less dangerous. So why it may be more harmful in women? First, we've got to establish, yes, it is more harmful. And second, identify why. A couple of things to bear in mind is that, especially after menopause, the prevalence of apnea in women seems to be significantly increased. So it's as they get older, they tend to have a higher level of sleep apnea than before menopause, and that may be in part due to weight gain around the abdominal area, maybe some fat accumulation around the neck, and whether the absence of the protective benefit of being premenopausal is lost after menopause, and that double whammy of A, losing the protection that you get when you're younger and then being postmenopausal, and then B, developing sleep apnea on top of that. Maybe that's why it's more harmful, but we still have to investigate that.
If it's bad for your blood pressure, is it also bad for arrhythmia or strokes or heart attacks?
Very much so. People who have sleep apnea have a much higher likelihood of cardiac arrhythmias, particularly atrial fibrillation. Why is this? It's because the atrium is the part that gets stretched the most when they're apneic. They certainly have a higher risk for strokes, and there are many reasons for this, including the fact that sleep apnea makes the blood more coagulable. And yes, they have a higher likelihood of heart attacks, particularly heart attacks that occur during the night. So if a patient has a heart attack that occurs at nighttime when they're asleep, that wakes them from sleep, you really have to consider whether they have sleep apnea. Now, having said all this, I want to point out that we still have not proven that treating obstructive sleep apnea lowers the risks of atrial fibrillation or heart attack or stroke. We think it will, but we still don't have the definitive evidence to prove that that's the case. We do know sleep apnea treatment decreases your level of daytime sleepiness, which means you're at lower risk for motor vehicle accidents and at lower risk for accidents at work and at lower risk for being away from work because of sickness.
We've been talking about obstructive sleep apnea and cardiac risk with Mayo Clinic cardiologist Dr. Varen Summers. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Summers.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Tracy. Thanks.
And that's our program for this week.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Tracy McCrae. Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.